So we have enormous knowledge of Augustine. And we know of other in the family, two other siblings, Navigius, who comes into the story in his Confessions, and then a sister. We do not know her name. And it's interesting whom Augustine does not name in his various works. He never names his sister, even though his sister lived right next door to him for most of his life. She founded a small community, semi-monastic community of women who had devoted themselves to a celibate lifestyle. And they built their little community right next to the church, and Augustine's house was right next to the church. And he never names her. And it's very, very curious. But so be it. Now, Patricius is a pagan. He becomes a professing Christian on his deathbed. He dies around 372. His mother, though, who dies in 387, Patricius is dead by 372. His mother dies either 387 or 388. His father is a pagan, his mother is a Christian. And it would appear from my reading of the sources that his mother was married off at a young age by pagan parents, although she had become a Christian or subsequently became a Christian. And she found herself literally saddled with a man who was not sympathetic to her spirituality or piety at all. And there are a number of scenes in, a couple of scenes in the Confessions in which Augustine clearly indicates something of the tensions that were in that home. And certainly, Monica did all she could to raise her son in the Christian faith and to pass on to him Christian truth. But there was a struggle going on in that home. Patricius, as I said, would not accept Christianity until his deathbed. He was an official in the Roman bureaucracy in this part of the Roman world, aspiring to better himself. He sacrificed considerably to give his son a liberal education, and by liberal I mean liberal arts. And the goal of all of that was that his son would have an honored position in society, in Africa, and possibly in another part of the Roman Empire. And Augustine then studied first at De Gast, and then at the age of 17, in 371, he goes to Carthage to university. So his birth is 354. He studies at De Gast, and then in 371, he goes to Carthage to study further. And the goal of this study is to eventually to get a training in rhetoric, and he'll become a rhetorician. He was to be in Carthage until 383. Now, his mother will have the strongest influence on him. His mother figures largely in the Confessions. His father hardly figures at all. And he will say in one of his books, The Happy Life, just after his conversion, that it was his mother's prayers who God answered and to bring him to Christ. Now, before he went to Carthage, Monica warned him about two things he should not do. Never to engage in fornication, never to contemplate committing the sin of adultery. And but Augustine could say in his Confessions, I went to Carthage, where I found myself in the midst of a hissing cauldron of lust. My real need was for you, my God, who are the food of the soul, but I was not aware of this hunger. And his first year at Carthage, Augustine found himself living the life of, in far too many ways, a typical North American student at a university. And many things change in the world. Many things have changed in the world between that day and our day, obviously. Some things have not changed. And the way in which students who go away to university use their freedom in that context for what Paul talks there about rioting and drunkenness and immorality is exactly what Augustine did. He threw himself for a year into this kind of circle or cycle of immorality, going to the what we would describe today as the bawdy theater, the pagan theater being very immoral, using sex in search of love, consorting with a group known as the Evasores. It sounds like some sort of philosophical group until you find out that their name is translated as the Smashers. And the Evasores, E-V-E-R-S-O-R-E-S, the Evasores were a group of basically hooligans, ruffians. And although Augustine himself never participated in this particular action, this was one of their favorite actions was in the areas of the university where classes were going on, they would line up outside the door of a class where a professor might be teaching, and then suddenly burst in, kick over the tables, create a huge disturbance, then run out. And Augustine himself never appears to have participated in that, but he would later in his own teaching career complain mightily of this sort of activity of these hooligans in the context in which he would be teaching. However, within 2 years, it's all changed. I read recently a short bio of Augustine. I forget the context right now, but the bio basically gave the reader the impression. Oh, I know what it was. It was in a book called 20 Books You Should Read, something like this, published by a popular Christian publishing house. And those sort of things I find interesting, because I'm interested in what kind of books are being promoted in terms of our history. Well, one of them was Augustine, and they'd have a short bio and then a section from the Confessions. And in the short bio, you came away with a distinct impression that Augustine lived as a rake, a sexually immoral man, basically in terms of this promiscuity, all the way up to his conversion. Well, that isn't true. And it's only right at the beginning of that time when he goes to Carthage, and then he has a woman who moves in with him as a common law wife. And in his context, she's described as a concubine, but it's really like a common law arrangement in which he probably would have ended up staying with her all his life if certain circumstances had not been not transpired. In other words, he is not promiscuous in that sense, although we will see at the end of this period, right before his conversion, there is something that takes place to Augustine that the real problem in his life is sexual lust and the bondage of sexual lust. So within 2 years of his going to Carthage, he is completely, he's changed in a number of areas. He takes a concubine. I suspect we might call it a common law relationship. He initially enters into that relationship because it was typical of Roman middle classes, upper classes, where young men would have a woman move in with them like this, who was not of the same social class, and then when it came time for them to marry after they had gotten a career in their late 20s, this is obviously in pagan culture, they'd basically dump that woman and enter into a marriage, a legal marriage of somebody of their as their social equal. Augustine, that's the initial thinking, obviously, of Augustine. He eventually grows to love the woman deeply and would never have given her up if certain circumstances had not forced his hand. And he will have a son by her. What's interesting is he never names her. He never names her either. Now, in a recent biography by Gary Wills, which is called St. Augustine, it's an interesting biography in some respects. I'm not sure I fully recommend it. It's one of those. It was put out in a Penguin series of lives. There was a variety of lives put out by Penguin. Very short lives. You can read them in about 2 or 3 hours. I remember reading it once on a plane coming from Florida to Buffalo. And he speculates something. He doesn't give any sources. The book's frustrating because there are no footnotes. It's meant to be a very quick read. But he mentions in there that Augustine doesn't name her because she was subsequently converted and was part of one of the communities in North Africa. And he doesn't name her lest he embarrass her. I don't know where he gets that from. I'd never come across it anywhere else. Now, Wills has just translated all of the confessions. And there's nothing like that in the confessions. But it could be the case that he's read it somewhere else and in one of Augustine's pieces. But he doesn't name it, and it's a bit of a... I think it's speculation. But nonetheless, he has by her a son whom he names Adeodatus, which is interesting because the name means a gift from God. Datus, gift, or given. Adeo, from God, or by God. And indicative of the fact that his mother's influence was not completely eradicated, even though initially when he went up to Carthage, he certainly disobeyed her advice. The other thing that takes place in this period also is that he reads a book. And so 372, he takes a concubine, and then also reads Cicero's, or Cicero's, Hortensius. And Hortensius was a dialogue in which Cicero, the Roman pre-Christian philosopher, urged men to seek wisdom by study of philosophy. We do not have the book, and all we have are certain quotes, and some of the quotes come from Augustine. And Augustine, it changed his entire life in terms of his thinking. And some writers, wouldn't follow this, but some writers talk about this as kind of a conversion. He's radically changed from man who is seeking things of this world to a man now who begins to try to seek wisdom. And Augustine says this about it: it altered my outlook on life. It changed my prayers to you, O Lord. All my empty dreams suddenly lost their charm. My heart began to throb with a bewildering passion for the wisdom of eternal truth. I began to climb out of the depths which I had sunk in order to return to you. My God, how I burned with longing to have wings to carry me back to you, away from all earthly things, although I had no idea what you'd do with me. For yours is the wisdom. In Greek, the word philosophy means love of wisdom, and it was with this love that the Hortensius inflamed me. Now, the one place that he doesn't seek wisdom, though, is in the Christianity of his mother. And the reason for that is because he has an awareness of his own genius. And as far as he's concerned, Christianity is for slaves and for women. It's not something for a man with any degree of brilliance, as he knows he has, to embrace. And truth be told, up to this point in his life, he had really never met a Christian who was anywhere intellectually interesting. And so he assumed that Christianity is an intellectual dead end. And it was G.K. Chesterton, I think, who once said that if men won't believe the truth, they'll believe anything. And that's exactly how his life now unfolds. Because instead of finding wisdom among where he should have found it in the church, he turns to a cult known as Manichaeanism. And roughly from 373 all the way through definitely to 383, Augustine is caught up with the Manichaeism, which is named after a Persian named Mani, 216 to 276. Now, this is basically a Gnostic cult. Mani believed that he actually was the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit had so come upon him that there had been a union of soul and mind. And Mani thus emphasized that he was the promised paraclete of John 14 to 16. But the Manichaeism that Augustine became familiar with, he was actually executed in Persia in 216, but Manichaeism never really took off in Persia, but it did spread into the Roman Empire, and in the fourth century, it became a very popular religion among certain upper-class individuals and middle-class. And it's basically Gnosticism, is what it is. A radical cosmological dualism with asceticism. And the idea of Gnosticism was that little fragments of God had been scattered throughout the universe in both animals and plants, a result of a war between good and evil. And Mani believed that two types of plants especially contained a lot of divinity, and those were melons and cucumbers. And thus, if you ate a lot of melons and cucumbers, it produced in your life a fullness of the Spirit. And as I said, if you don't believe the truth, you'll believe anything. And Mani also was regarded sexuality as the work of the devil, and thus celibacy was encouraged. This meant that Augustine was never a key member, a full member of the sect. He was an adherent, but not a full member. And one of the great issues of Manichaeism was the issue of the origin of evil. And Augustine struggled to get some clear answers from the Manichaeans on where did evil come from. They talked a lot about evil. Eating meat was evil. Sexuality was evil. But where did it come from? And everybody kept telling him that there is a brilliant Manichaean teacher named Faustus. He didn't live in North Africa. But when you meet Faustus, everything, all your questions will be answered and all doubts dispelled. Well, finally, around 382, 383, Augustine meets Faustus. And Augustine finds out the guy's half an idiot. A half-educated individual who all he's got is a bunch of slogans. And Augustine realizes, basically, suddenly the penny drops around 383, and he realizes he has been had. He's been involved in a group who've really got no answers to anything. And so it is that by the time in 383, when he leaves Carthage to go to Rome, he will be moving out of Manichaean circles completely. In 383, he goes to Rome. His great goal in going to Rome was to further his career. By this time, Rome was not the city it had been 200 years before, or even 100 years before. The capital of military capital of the Roman Empire in the West was really no longer Rome. It was in northern Italy, near Milan, named a place called Ravenna. It's not on the map there. But the Roman emperors invariably were ruling now not from Rome, but from Ravenna. And the city of Rome then had ceased really in many respects to have, in the late 4th century, to have significant political and military significance of the empire. Nobody said that much. Nobody ever said that. But that's the truth of the reality. However, it was still regarded with enormous prestige. And anybody who wanted to further their career invariably ended up going to Rome. And it is here, then, Augustine hopes to win academic prestige. The other thing he's also seeking here is he's seeking wealthier pupils. They'll pay more. much of the university system then is very different from now, where there is a central administrative bureaucracy, students enroll, and then are assigned classes. And there, the professors, in very many ways, had to recruit their own students. And he's determined to go to Rome. There's going to be wealthier students. His mother, on the other hand, is determined that he doesn't go. His mother is quite convinced that the only way he's ever going to get converted is if she's near him. She's got no interest in going to Rome, so she really tries to prevent him. And there's a great scene in Book 5 of the Confessions where Augustine eventually does go to Rome, but he has to lie to his mother to do so. And they're on the docks in Carthage. They're walking along the docks, and there is a boat that Augustine has booked passage on. And he needs to get on the boat before nightfall because it was going to sail at first light. And but what's he going to do with his mother? Because his mother's with him the whole time, basically kind of dogging his footsteps and not wanting to let him go. And so he lies to her. He tells her that he's got a friend on board who's going to make the trip and to go back home, and he'll be there shortly that week. Later on that following day. And he says the light came up, the wind, there was a wind that filled our sails, and we had sailed to Rome. And his mother goes, finds him not there, and realizes that her son has lied to her. And she begins to ask God in her prayers, what on earth is he doing? How could he allow her son to escape this way? And Augustine says that you did not answer her immediate prayers, that you might answer her deeper prayers. You did not answer a prayer, please keep him here. But you answered that prayer that he might come to Christ, because it was in going to Rome that he'd be led to Milan and there to Christ. In Rome, everything goes wrong. He arrives in the summer. That's the worst time to be in Rome in this period of time. The summer was could be fairly dreadful in Rome, in the summer, in those days anyway. Rome had been built on initially seven hills, but then as the city grew, by this period of time, the city is over 1 million people, largest city in the ancient world. And but the wealthy would get out of the city in the summertime because of such a crowded environment. It was a breeding ground for disease, especially with regard to the fact that in between the hills, much of that area had been swamp. Breeding ground for mosquitoes, carriers of various mosquito-borne diseases. The Romans had drained all that, but it was still very damp. And the summer could be a very deadly time in terms of plague and disease. Augustine falls ill. He nearly dies. The students he has, he's got a lot of wealthy students, but they won't pay their fees. And so within the space of a year, he is utterly discouraged. And it has not turned out to be the career-advancing trip that he thought it would be. While in Rome, in 384, he hears of a professorship in Milan. And so in 384, he decides to take it, and he moves north to Milan. And it is here that he'll come across a man that he can admire, who is a Christian. Admire, that is, intellectually. He rents a house from a fellow North African named Werikundus. And this house that he rents is of significant size because Augustine, one of the things that Augustine is noted for is that around him, most of his life are friends. And he needs a house large enough to accommodate a number of friends who had come with him from North Africa. Alypius, Avodius, his son is there, his common-law wife, his brother Navigius. And in the course of 384, we've got no idea how this happens, but his mother finds out where he is. And unless he's written back to her and to tell her, it'd be very difficult to track people in this period of time. Anyway, his mother finds out where he is, and she also arrives in Milan. And she's thrilled when she gets there because she finds her son is going to church in the great central church in Milan to listen to the preaching of a man named Ambrose. And Ambrose of Milan is one of he's an very important theologian in the mid 4th century. He would die in 397. He was a very eloquent preacher. Some of his theological work, some of his ecclesiological work is of significance. His other theological work is much of it is plagiarized. Plagiarism, by the way, in the ancient world is not it's not what it is for us. Some of these ancient authors had no problems taking a chunk out of somebody else, putting it in their own book, and never acknowledging it. And now Ambrose does acknowledge it, but his book on the Holy Spirit, for example, is basically he takes Basil of Caesarea and translates it into Latin. And so he's not in one sense the sort of thinker of the caliber of Augustine. Nonetheless, Augustine is deeply impressed. He has finally met a Christian who, in his mind, has a mind. And there was a piety there that was attractive to Augustine. And most importantly, Ambrose showed him how to read initially Genesis 1 to 3, which was a major problem for Augustine. Augustine's problem with Genesis 1 to 3 was that the way that he had heard it taught, it did not appeal to his intellectualism. Now, all this will change once he's converted. All this will change. But Augustine was attracted to Ambrose also because Ambrose allegorized a lot of Genesis 1 to 3. And Augustine, you can track through Augustine's career, his early reflections on Genesis 1 to 3 are allegorical. By the time that you get to, he actually writes and never finishes two commentaries on Genesis. By the time you get to the second one, written in the 14s, somewhere in the between 410, 415, he's actually significantly moved from an allegorical exegesis. But that's down the road. Initially, what attracts him to Ambrose is Ambrose's ability to allegorize a text. And slowly then, as he's listening to the preaching of the word, engaging in worship, God is bringing conviction into his heart. Describing Ambrose's preaching, Augustine can say this: I was all ears to seize upon his eloquence. I also began to sense the truth of what he said, though only gradually. I thrilled with love and dread alike. I realized I was far away from you, and far off I heard your voice saying, I am the God who is. This is not conversion. This is what we call awakening. In Augustine's own words, I was astonished that although I now loved you, I did not persist in enjoyment like God. Your beauty drew me to you, but soon I was dragged away from you by my own weight, and in dismay I plunged again into the things of this world. Now, the things of this world are primarily his relationship with the woman in his life, either however you want to call this relationship, concubine or common law wife. When Monica arrives, the one area that is clearly of sin in her life now will now take place. Monica, her son's going back to church. He's now he's 30 years old. He's got a good career. He's a professor of rhetoric in Milan. Time to settle down. And she finds in the congregation a family that is of their social class, probably a bit higher. They have a young daughter who probably is around 14 or 15, not yet old enough to marry, but she proposes an arranged marriage. And the family accepts, and she basically tells Augustine, her son, look, that's it, the woman goes. This is a good Christian marriage, good Christian family, they've got a daughter, she'll be your social equal, it's just fabulous, the woman goes. And Augustine is prevailed upon by his mother's sinful suggestion. And he could say this: the woman with whom I had been living was torn from my side as an obstacle to my marriage, and this was a blow which crushed my heart to bleeding, because I loved her dearly. She went back to Africa, vowing never to give herself to any other man. And Gary Wills, as I said, argues that she was subsequently converted. I don't know of the evidence of that. But he goes on to say, I was too unhappy, too weak to imitate this example set me. I took another mistress without the sanction of wedlock. Now, see, all of his life, Augustine thought, why haven't I become a Christian? Well, the standing block for him, the barrier to become a Christian, was intellectual. You know, there was no one in Africa he ever met who was in any way, shape, or form, in his mind, intellectually bent, and therefore Christianity was for women and slaves. He meets Ambrose. And he gets involved in the cult of the Manichaeans because of the issue of how to explain evil. He thought the Manichaeans had an explanation, but he finds that it's all hollow and empty. He goes to listen to Ambrose, and the reason why Ambrose is attractive is the intellectual content of his preaching, the ability of Ambrose to be, in his mind, a skilled exegete. His whole problem, he feels, is intellectual. What this experience teaches him, his main problem is a bondage of the will. It's not intellectual. The fact is, he's in bondage to lust. He's lived with a woman close to 10 years. He's a son by her. It's really a common law marriage. What his mother should have told him was, you need to give this relationship the sanction of a full-fledged marriage. But instead, she is led away by her own cultural, it's a cultural sin, and forces Augustine to break with the woman. The woman was that he was now engaged to was not old enough yet to marry, and so he takes another mistress, which brings home to Augustine the depth of his problem. His problem is not primarily intellectual. The problem is a volitional and affective, affective. Now that's all the background. It's very important you see that. And Augustine lays this out with great detail in the Confessions. It is no wonder that the Puritan John Owen, in his great work on the Holy Spirit, has a long chapter on the Confessions as a model of how often God brings men and women to faith in Christ. And the Puritans saw in this a paradigm. And whether or not they were right to pick out all of the elements exactly, nonetheless, there is a rich scriptural ring of truth to Augustine's experience. That the stumbling block for most men and women is an issue of the will. Not for most at all. It's not the intellectual questions have to be answered. There have to be answers given to them. But that is not what prevents men and women from becoming Christians. It is their refusal, rooted in the bondage of the will, to embrace the gospel. Now that lies in the background then, and so we come then to the year 386, in August of 386, which is the time that God had set for his conversion. And Augustine is, as I said, in this house, this rented home, with his close friend at this point in time named Alypius. And on a particular day in August of 386, a fellow North African who is a member of the Roman bureaucracy named Ponticianus comes to visit. And Ponticianus is a Christian. And there is now going to transpire the details leading to Augustine's conversion, which is related in Confessions, Book 8, 12. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to break here, and when we come back after the break, we're going to read through a number of the sections of his Confessions. I would recommend strongly getting hold of Peter Brown's book, reading it. I think it's a very good, faithful depiction of Augustine. And then secondly, I would recommend, definitely, if you don't have it, reading the Confessions. You won't agree with everything that's there, to have not have read the Confessions is to have missed out on one of the great treasures of the Church. Okay, any questions before we break? It's 10 after 9. We shall break till 20 after, 10 minutes. Those notes. And what I'm going to do is take you through some of Augustine's Confessions, Book 8. And again, I've given you a biographical sketch of Augustine, this one by Ronald Nash. And then I want to pick up, this is a translation by Fulton Sheed. And the reason for my using this translation, my preferred translation is the one by a man named Pine Coffin, which is a curious name. I suspect part of the reason for my liking the translation, it's the one that I first read. There were cadences and phrases that became familiar to me and so on. There are some more recent translations of the Confessions, but the one that I like is the Pine Coffin, which is published by Penguin. This one I use because, again, it's in the public domain, and so issues of copyright did not emerge. But I want to take you to Section 6. I'm going to take you through some portions of this, obviously not read it all. You will, in the assignment that I'm going to give you, be expected to go through the whole chapter and answer a number of questions. So I'm really then looking at page 137 on that section there. This is Book 8, Chapter 6 of the Confessions. And I'm going to start at the top of the page, 137 there. First paragraph. On a certain day, Nebridius was away for some reason I cannot recall. There came to Alypius and me at our house one Ponticianus, a fellow countryman of ours, being from Africa, holder of an important post in the emperor's court. There was something or other he wanted of us, and we sat down to discuss the matter. As it happened, he noticed a book on a gaming table by which we were sitting. He picked it up, opened it, and found that it was the Apostle Paul, which surprised him, because he had expected that it would be one of the books I wore myself out teaching. Then he smiled a little and looked at me and expressed pleasure, but surprise, too, at having come suddenly upon that book, and only that book, lying before me. For he was a Christian, and a devout Christian. He knelt before you in church, O our God, in daily prayer, many times daily. I told him that I had given much care to these writings. Whereupon he began to tell the story of the Egyptian monk Antony, whose name was held in high honor among your servants, although Alypius and I had never heard it before. I'd never heard it before that time. When he learned this, he was more intent upon telling the story, anxious to introduce so great a man to men ignorant of him, and very much marveling at our ignorance. But Alypius and I stood amazed to hear of your wonderful works done in the true faith and in the Catholic Church, Catholic there being with the idea of universal and not the Roman Catholic Church. So recently, practically in our own times, with such numbers of witnesses, all three of us were filled with wonder, but we, because the deeds we were now learning were so great, hearing were so great, and he, because we had never heard them before. From this story, he went on to the great groups in the monasteries, and their ways all redolent of you, and the fertile deserts of the wilderness, all of which we knew nothing. There was actually a monastery at Milan, outside the city walls. It was full of worthy brethren under the care of Ambrose, and we had not heard of it. He continued with his discourse, and we listened in absolute silence. It chanced that he told how on one occasion he and three of his companions, it was at Treves, when the emperor was at the chariot races in the circus, had gone one afternoon to walk in the gardens close to the city walls. As it happens, they fell into two groups, one of the others staying with him, and the other two likewise walking their own way. But as those other two strolled on, they came into a certain house, the dwelling of some servants of yours, poor in spirit, of whom is the kingdom of God. And then they found a small book in which was written the life of Antony. One of them began to read it, marveled at it, was inflamed by it. While he was actually reading, he had begun to think how he might embrace such a life and give up his worldly employment to serve you alone. For the two men were both state officials. Suddenly, the man who was doing the reading was filled with a love of holiness
and angry at himself with righteous shame. He looked at his friend and said to him, "Tell me, please, what is the goal of our ambition in all these labors of ours? What are we aiming at? What is our motive in being in the public services? Have we any higher hope at court than to be friends of the emperor? And at that level, is not everything uncertain and full of perils? And how many perils must we meet on the way to this greater peril? And how long before we are there? But if I should choose to be a friend of God, I can become one now." He said this, and all troubled. With the pain of the new life coming to birth in him, he turned his eyes to the book. He read on and was changed inwardly, where you alone could see, and the world dropped away from his mind as soon appeared outwardly. But while he was reading, and his heart thus tossing on its own flood, at length he broke out in heavy weeping, saw the better way, and chose it for his own. Being now your servant, he said to his friend, "Now I have broken from that hope we had, and have decided to serve God. Now I enter upon that service from this hour and this place. If you will have no will to imitate me, at least do not try to dissuade me." The other replied that he would remain his companion in so great a service for so great a prize. And so the two of them, now your servants, built a spiritual tower at the only cost that is adequate, the cost of leaving all things and following you. Then Potikianus, the man who had gone walking with him in another part of the garden, came looking for them in the same place. When he found them, suggested they should return home as the day was now declining. But they told their decision and their purpose and how that will had arisen in them and was now settled in them, and asked them not to try to argue them out of their decision, even if they would not also join them. Ponticianus, his friend, though not changed from their former state, yet wept for themselves, as he told us, and congratulated them in God, and commended themselves to their prayers. Then with their own heart trailing in the dust, they went off to the palace, while the other two, with their heart fixed upon heaven, remained in the hut. Both these men, as it happened, were betrothed, and when the two women heard of it, they likewise dedicated their virginity to you. This was the story Ponticianus told. But you, Lord, while he was speaking, turned me back towards myself, taking me from behind my own back, where I put myself all the time that I preferred not to see myself. And you set me there before my own face, and that I might see how vile I was, how twisted and unclean and spotted and ulcerous. I saw myself and was horrified. There was no way to flee from myself. If I tried to turn my gaze from myself, there was Ponticianus telling what he was telling. And again, you are setting me face to face with myself, forcing me upon my own sight, that I might see my iniquity and loathe it. I had known it, but I had pretended not to see it, had deliberately looked the other way and let it go from my mind. But this time, the more ardently I approved those two as I heard of their determination to win health for their souls by giving themselves up wholly to your healing, the more detestable did I find myself in comparison with them. For many years had flowed by, a dozen or more, from the time when I was 19, and was stirred by the reading of Cicero's Hortensius to the study of wisdom. And here was I, still postponing the giving up of this world's happiness, to devote myself to the search for that of which not the finding only, but the mere seeking is better than to find all the treasures and kingdoms of men, better than all the body's pleasures, though they were to be had merely for a nod. But I, in my great worthlessness, for it was greater thus early, had begged you for chastity, saying, "Grant me chastity and continence," but not yet. For I was afraid that you would hear my prayer too soon, and too soon would heal me from the disease of lust, which I wanted satisfied rather than extinguished. And so I had gone wandering in my sacrilegious superstitions with the base ways of the Manichaeans. Not indeed that I was sure they were right, but I preferred them to the Christians, whom I did not inquire about in the spirit of religion, but simply opposed through malice. I thought that my reason for putting off from day to day the following of you alone to the contempt of earthly hopes was I did not see any certain goal towards which to direct my steps. But now the day was come, when I stood naked in my own sight, and my conscience accused me. Why is my voice not heard? Surely you are the man. You used to say that you could not cast off vanity's baggage for an uncertain truth. Very well, now the truth is certain, yet you are still carrying the load. Here are men who have been given wings to free their shoulders from the load, though they did not wear themselves out in searching, nor spend 10 years or more thinking about it. Thus was I inwardly gnawed at. I was in the grip of the most horrible and confounding shame while Ponticianus was telling his story. He finished the tale and the business for which he had come, and he went his way, and I to myself. What did I not say against myself? With what lashes of condemnation did I scourge my soul to make it follow me now that I wanted to follow you? My soul hung back. It would not follow, yet found no excuse for not following. All its arguments had been used and refuted. There remained only trembling silence, for it feared as very death the cessation of that habit of which, in truth, it was dying. In the midst of that great tumult of my inner dwelling place, the tumult I had stirred up against my own soul in the chamber of my heart, I turned upon Olympias, wild in look, troubled in my heart, crying out, "What is wrong with us? Why, what is this that you heard? The unlearned rise, take heaven by force, and here we are with all our learning stuck fast in flesh and blood. Is there any shame in following because they have gone before us? Would it not be a worse shame not to follow at once?" These words and more the same I uttered. Then the violence of my feeling tore me from him while he stood staring at me, thunderstruck. For I did not sound like myself. My brow, cheeks, eyes, flush, the pitch of my voice spoke my mind more powerfully than the words I uttered. There was a garden attached to our lodging, of which we had the use, as we indeed had of the whole house, for our host, the master of the house, did not live there. To this garden the storm in my breast somehow brought me, for there no one could intervene in the fierce suit I had brought against myself until it should reach its issue. What the issue was to be, you knew, not I. But there I was, going mad on my way to sanity, dying on my way to life, aware how evil I was, unaware that I was to grow better in a little while. So I went off to the garden, and Olympias close on my heels, for it was still privacy for me to have him near, and how could he leave me to myself in that state? We found a seat as far as possible from the house. I was frantic in mind, in a frenzy of indignation at myself for not going over to your law and your covenant, O my God, where all my bones cried out that I should be, extolling it to the skies. The way was not by ship or chariot or on foot. It was not as far as I had gone when I went from the house to the place where we sat. For I had but will to go, in order not merely to go but to arrive. I had only to will to go, but to will powerfully and wholly, not to turn and twist to will half wounded this way and that, with the part that would rise struggling against the part that would keep to the earth. In the torment of my irresolution, I did many bodily acts. Now men sometimes will to do bodily acts, but cannot, whether because they have not the limbs, or because their limbs are bound, or weakened with illness, or in some other way unable to act. If I tore my hair, if I beat my forehead, if I locked my fingers and clasped my knees, I did it because I willed it to. But I might have willed and yet not done it, if my limbs had not had the pliability to do what I willed. And thus I did so many things with a will to do them, was not at all the same thing as the power to them. And I did not do what would have pleased me incomparably more to do, a thing to which I could have given, I could have done as soon as I will to, given that willing means willing wholly. For in that matter, the power was the same thing as the will, and the willing was the doing. Yet it was not done, and the body more readily obeyed the slightest wish of the mind, and more readily moved its limbs at the mind's mere nod, than the mind obeyed itself in carrying out its own great will, which could be achieved simply by willing. And then he goes on to talk about the struggle that was going on in his life. And I want to jump over to page 144, section 11. Thus, I was sick at heart and in torment. This is the third line on the page 144, section 11. Accusing myself of a new intensity of bitterness, twisting and turning in my chain in the hope that it might be surely broken. For what held me was so small a thing, but it still held me. And you stood in the secret places of my soul, O Lord, in the harshness of your mercy, redoubling the scourges of fear and shame, lest I should give way again, and that slight, small tie which remained should not be broken, but should grow again to full strength and bind me closer even than before. For I kept saying within myself, let it be now, let it be now. And by the mere words I had begun to move towards the resolution. I almost made it, yet I did not quite make it. But I did not fall back into my original safe, but as it were, stood near to get my breath. And I tried again, and I was almost there. And now I could all but touch it and hold it, yet I was not quite there. I did not touch it or hold it. I still shrank from dying unto death and living unto life. The lower condition which had grown habitual was more powerful than the better condition which I had not tried. The nearer the point of time came in which I was to become different, the more it struck with horror. But it did not force me utterly back, nor turn me utterly away, but held me there between the two. Those trifles of all trifles and vanities, my one-time mistresses held me back, plucking at my garment of flesh and murmuring softly, "Are you sending us away?" And from this moment, shall we not be with you, now or forever? And from this moment, shall this or that not be allowed you, now or forever? What were they suggesting to me? in phrases I've written, this or that. What were they suggesting to me, oh my God? Do you in your mercy keep the soul from the soul of your servant the vileness and uncleanness they were suggesting? And now I began to hear them, not half so loud. They no longer stood against me face to face, but were softly muttering behind my back. And as I tried to depart, plucking stealthily at me to make me look behind, yet even that was enough. So hesitating was I to keep me from snatching myself free, from shaking them off, from leaping upwards on the way I was called. For the strong force of habit to me, for the strong force of habit said to me, do you think you can live without them? By this time its voice was growing fainter. In the direction towards which I turned my face and was quivering in fear of going, I could see the austere beauty of countenance, serene and indeed joyous, but not evilly, honorably soliciting me to come to her and not linger, stretching forth loving hands to receive and embrace me, hands full of multitudes of good examples. With her I saw such hosts of young men and maidens, a multitude of youth and of every age, gray widows and women grown old in virginity, and in them all countenance herself, not barren but the fruitful mother of children, her joys by you, Lord, her spouse. And she smiled upon me, and her smile gave courage, as if she were saying, can you do what these men have done, what these women have done? Or could men and women have done such in themselves and not in the Lord their God? The Lord their God gave me to them. Why do you stand upon yourself and so not stand at all? Cast yourself upon him and be not afraid. He will not draw away and let you fall. Cast yourself without fear. He will receive you and heal you. Yet I was still ashamed, for I could still hear the murmuring of those vanities, and I still hung hesitant. And again it was as if she said, stop your ears against your unclean members, that they may be mortified. They tell you of delights, but not of such delights as the law of the Lord your God tells. This was the controversy raging in my heart, a controversy about myself, against myself. And Alypius stayed by my side and waited in silence the issue of such agitation as he had never seen in me. When my most searching scrutiny had drawn up all my vileness from the secret depths of my soul and heaped it in my heart's sight, a mighty storm arose in me, bringing a mighty rain of tears. That I might give way to my tears and lamentations, I rose from Alypius, for it struck me that solitude was more suited to the business of weeping. I went far enough from him to prevent his presence from being an embarrassment to me. So I felt, and he realized it. I suppose I had said something, and the sound of my voice was heavy with tears. I rose, but he remained where he had been sitting, where we had been sitting, still in utter amazement. I flung myself down somehow under a certain fig tree, and no longer tried to check my tears, which poured forth from my eyes in a flood, an acceptable sacrifice to thee. And much I said, not in these words, but this effect, and thou, O Lord, how long, O Lord, wilt thou be angry forever? Remember not our former iniquities. For I felt I was still bound by them. And I continued my miserable complaining. How long shall I go on saying and again, saying tomorrow and again tomorrow? Why not now? Why not have an end to my uncleanness this very hour? Such things I said, weeping in the most bitter sorrow of my heart. And suddenly I heard a voice from some nearby house, a boy's voice or a girl's voice, I do not know, but it was a sort of sing-song, repeated again and again. Take and read. Take and read. I ceased weeping and immediately began to search my mind most carefully as to whether children were accustomed to chant these words in any kind of game, and I could not remember that I'd ever heard any such thing. Damming back the flood of my tears, I rose, interpreting the incident as quite certainly a divine command to open my book of Scripture and read the passage of which I should open. For it was part of what I had been told about Antony, that from the Gospel, which he happened to be reading, he had felt that he was being admonished as though what he read was spoken directly to himself. Go, sell what thou hast, give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. By this experience he had been in that instant converted to you. So I was moved to return to the place where Alypius was sitting, for I put down the apostle's book there when I arose. I snatched it up, opened it, and in silence read the passage upon which my eyes first fell, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and impurities, not in contention and envy, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh in its concupiscences. That's Romans 13:13 we read earlier. I had no wish to read further, and had no need, for in that instance, with the very ending of the sentence, it was as though a light of utter confidence shone in all my heart, and all the darkness of uncertainty vanished away. Then leaving my finger in the place or marking it by some other sign, I closed the book and in complete calm told the whole thing to Alypius. And he similarly told me what had been going on in himself, of which I knew nothing. He asked to see what I had read. I showed him and looked further than I had read. I had not known what followed. And this is what happened. Now, him that is weak in faith, take unto you. He applied this to himself and told me so. And he was confirmed by this message, and with no trouble, and with no troubled wavering, gave himself to God's good will and purpose. Purpose indeed most suited to his character, for in these matters he had been immeasurably better than I. Then we went in and told my mother, and told her to her great joy. We related how it had come about. She was filled with triumph and exultation, and praised you who are mighty beyond what we asked or conceived. For she saw that you had given her more than with all her pitiful weeping she had ever asked. For you converted me to yourself. So I no longer sought a wife, nor any of this world's promises, but stood upon that same rule of faith in which you had shown me to her so many years before. And thus you changed her mourning into joy, a joy far richer than she had thought to wish, a joy much dearer and purer than she had thought to find in grandchildren of my flesh. And as with so many in this period of time, conversion was a conversion to a monastic lifestyle as well as conversion to Christ. And Augustine, that definitely is his conversion to Christ, but it is also an embrace of a monastic lifestyle. And within the year, in the spring of 387, he is baptized. Now let me quote from another text. This is later in the book, in which he, in chapter 9, he begins to talk about what did God do in his life, and he says these words: "During all those years of rebellion, where was my free will? What was the hidden secret place from which it was summoned in a moment, so I might bend my neck to your easy yoke? How sweet all at once it was for me to be rid of those fruitless joys which I had once feared to lose. You drove them from me, you who are the true, the sovereign joy. You drove them from me and took their place. You who are sweeter than all pleasure, though not to flesh and blood. You who outshine all light, yet are hidden deeper than any secret in our hearts. You who surpass all honor, though not in the eyes of men who see all honor in themselves. O Lord, my God, my light, my wealth, and my salvation." And so in the spring of 387, he was baptized in Milan. And I've never been to Milan, but I'm told that you can still go to the main cathedral of Milan and see the baptistry where he was baptized. For many people at that time, joining the church was becoming the fashionable road to success in a quote-unquote Christian world. And they took it casually and really kept their old ways with them. But Augustine certainly was not one of those. Now, in his early experience as a Christian, Augustine believes that God is going to lead him back to North Africa. Actually, Monica dies on the way. She dies at a place called Ostia in southern Italy. They are going to take a ship. And Monica dies en route. And Augustine does arrive back in 380. He comes back to Tagaste. And over the next 3 years, between 380 to 391, he and a number of his friends, pretty well all of his friends, are converted through his witness. And they decide to form a philosophical community. And it will be a community where they are kind of some sort of retreat center, combination retreat center, think tank, / semi-monastic environment. And he writes a number of books in this period of time. Most of them he will eventually disown in terms of their theological analysis. It's the writings of a man that he will later realize is very naive in terms of the riches of God's Scripture. And in the providence of God, God has very different plans for him. In 391, he is on the coast visiting a friend in Hippo Regius. And it's about 150 miles away. And he went there basically to visit a friend whom he hoped he could persuade to join them in Tagaste. Instead, it happened this way, that the congregation, who had a Greek bishop whose Latin wasn't great and whose preaching, therefore, was halting, and they had had an elder who did a lot of the preaching. He had died, and they needed an elder. And Augustine didn't know of this. He did know the practice sometimes in North Africa, where if a congregation needed a man, the man might be suddenly grabbed and ordained on the spot. He didn't fear anything, but he would later write these words, because that's exactly what happened to him. A slave may not contradict his Lord. I came to the city to see a friend whom I thought I might gain for God, that he might live with us. I felt secure. The place already had a bishop. I was grabbed. I was made an elder. From there, I became your bishop. And in other words, he's in the congregation. The bishop, the Greek bishop, realizes who he is. Well, this is just the man we need. And before they wouldn't let him out the door, they laid hold of him, laid hands on him, and ordained him. Now, when this normally happened, the gentleman would not stay. Augustine relates another account of a man who came from Italy, and a church that he knew did the same thing. And as soon as the ceremony was over, the guy bolted for the door, and they never saw him again. But Augustine took seriously that this was God's call in his life. And not exactly the same way as Calvin's call, but there are elements of similarity in it. Calvin also called, as Augustine was, without formal theological training. And Augustine realizes that. He doesn't know the scriptures. How on earth is he ever going to fill the role of a preacher? And so he asks the bishop, could he have a year to study the word? Actually, it turned out to really be about 2 years. And by 393... And so 391, then, he is ordained an elder at Hippo. 393, he begins to regularly preach. So he takes 2 years, really, to study the scriptures and to prepare himself to fulfill the role of a preacher. This is what he is for the rest of his life. Even though he becomes a bishop and he has duties there, he is a preacher for the rest of his life. That is the way to understand Augustine. He is a pastor and a preacher. One of the things I think that the way Augustine's career is misunderstood is that his subsequent career is often looked at through the prism of various controversies. The Donatist controversy, responding to the Manichaeans, the Pelagian controversy, the controversy about the nature of history in relationship to the fall of Rome. But that is to do a deep injustice to understanding Augustine. Augustine is primarily a pastor and a preacher. And the books are done on the side. Augustine is not, and this is true, by the way, all the way down to the for lack of a better dividing line, it's 1865 when the bulk of theology increasingly after that period since 1865 to the present day is done by men in an academic setting primarily who are not, some of them whom are not linked to the church. But that's never the way it is before then. What you have before then, theologians are always pastors. And what Augustine does in his creed, he's a pastoral theologian. Calvin is a pastoral theologian. Luther is a pastoral theologian. And which is quite remarkable when you think of the enormous achievement that these men turn out. And it's quite remarkable that Augustine was able to write so much. Now, he wasn't married and he didn't have a family. But he did have a household he took care of, and a household that included a number of brothers who lived with him there. But also, at times, there were individuals in the larger community who needed spiritual help, who would end up turning up on the doorstep, and Augustine would take them in. And that's critical to understand that.